For Tynus and Derek Axton in Saskatchewan, community started with family, moved underground into the soil, and continued upward, working along with their neighbors to provide their homegrown and processed grains. Axton Farms is regenerating soil, improving water holding capacity, filtration, and cover. Then everything else magically fell into place. Well, that along with their 12 to 18 hour workdays, that is. Fortunately, all of this came into their focus before 2003 when the drought conditions hit. Tynus is with us sharing what and how it's done on their multi-generational farm that's been up and running in the family since 1916. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio for June 2026. Grab your earbuds and/or a shovel and let's dig in. Tynus, wow, I am totally in awe of what you all are doing up there. Do you ever sit back and be amazed yourself?
More just exhausted. We always want to do more, but there's time.
Right. That's an honest answer if there ever was one. Tynus, to start, tell us about your farm, the location, acreage, crops you grow, and how long you've been pointed in the direction of doing things regeneratively.
Okay. Well, yeah, my husband and I, we took over his family's farm. Well, we were married in 2002 and moved back to the farm. Around 2006, 2007, we started making a lot of the management decisions and taking over the farm. And I guess I could back up. We're Axton Farms at Minton, Saskatchewan, south central Saskatchewan, just north of the U.S. border. It's very rolling hills, very dry climate, but beautiful. Once we took over the farm, being as a low rainfall area, water was really our limiting factor. So we knew we had to make some changes to try to keep as much moisture in the soil as possible. A lot of times when we get rain in the summer, it'll be thunderstorms, so you get a lot of rain fast. And to see water run off the soil is very disheartening because, you know, you need every drop you can get inside.
Of course, yes.
So we originally decided that we needed to disturb the soil less, and we went to the U.S. to buy a disc drill. And the guy that we had bought the drill from said, oh, you must be going to see Dr. Duane Beck at the research farm here. And we weren't aware of any soil health concepts or this movement at all. And it just kind of snowballed from there. You know, we learned about disturbing the soil less. But for us, we didn't understand the whole biological concept of it. And it wasn't until we started learning more from people like Gabe Brown and Duane Beck and Dr. Elaine Ingham how soil was really supposed to function. It really changed our entire view of farming. And I took Dr. Elaine Ingham's Life in the Soils classes and learned what biology should be in the soil. Got to look and see how we were really lacking a lot of diversity within the soil, and just started making plans of, you know, little things that we could start doing. I made the motto of our farm, loyal to the soil. So anything we do, we really keep in mind the soil first and the biology that lives in it. So with that, we've added a lot of diversity to our farm. We grow cereals, legumes, and oil seeds. A lot of the cereals we grow are ancient grains. So things like spelt and red fife, einkorn, corzan. But we also do rye and oats, spring wheat.
And you grow
oil
a
seeds.
Lot
we
of
do
it.
Camelina, flax, mustard. We don't love pulses for the fact that they don't leave good ground cover. So we're working to get around that a little bit. But we've started growing different types of beans like red and pink and black. And then also some black and green lentils, desi chickpeas. So we really do find the more diversity you have above ground, you know, you get more diversity below ground. So it's really important.
I'm wondering what kind of bravery was involved in that, because so many people talk about how the older farmers have their way of doing things and to step out and do this, even though the evidence seems to be in that it's a very good move to make, both for the earth and for the pocketbook.
Yeah, a lot of it, I think, comes down to mindset. We always recommend, like, it's nice to do trials to see what'll work. My husband is not good at trials. He's an all-in guy. So we started with some pretty big trials. But, you know, it really came down to, if we're not going to do something, what can we do instead? So our first year, we cut way back in synthetic fertilizer, probably more than a guy should. But instead, we had made compost and made compost extracts so that we were able to put some biology back and really focused on biological foods to really stimulate the biology and add more biology so that they could start cycling nutrients for us. And as it turned out, it was a really dry year. So even, you know, people that had done full fertility, crops were hurt so bad that it was a good year to make a huge transition because the yields just weren't there anyways with no moisture. I think that growing season we had less than an inch of rain.
Oh,
so it was just, you know, you could only do so much. Yeah, so really trying to find that balance. The thing with a lot of the changes that we've made, you don't always see the rewards right away. You know, we started doing a lot of cover cropping. We had some friends also that started cover cropping, and they're like, yeah, I didn't see a difference, so they quit, you know, after 1 year.
Mm.
You know, you're playing the long game. It's, you're not always going to see changes overnight. And the joys of farming, variables are different every year. You know, sometimes we'll seed a lot of cover crops after we harvest, and we won't get a drop of rain, so they don't germinate. And then they do in the spring, and it's an issue. And, you know, there's so many different variables. It's not like, you know, you should do this, this, and this, and this will work. But
right, and it'll work in this way and in this time frame when all of the balance truly is moment to moment almost, I would imagine.
For a seeding plan, you kind of got to have one before spring. But we end up pivoting a lot just looking at the soil. We had a horrific winds this spring that even after everything we've done to try to have good soil cover, because it was the first year we were growing beans, we didn't intercrop or have anything with them because we just were learning how to grow them. So there wasn't much residue left on the field going into winter and this spring. And the wind moved soil. It was unbelievable. It broke our hearts to see our soil move because it's the last thing we want to happen, but no one's perfect, and conditions change all the time, and these bad winds were not something we had experienced before. So we changed our plan. We didn't want to touch that field until winds dropped and we got some moisture, because the last thing we wanted to do is lose more soil. So, yeah, seeding has been a little bit later going into that, and, you know, making sure now that we know we need something high carbon, something with some good roots to really try to restore all the damage that was done to those fields.
So what would you choose then for a high carbon and good root system plant?
So we're putting oats into the one field that blew quite bad because we ended up seeding a little bit later. It was something that still has time for maturity.
Right.
And then a big change we made. So now wherever we've seeded beans, we also seeded alfalfa. So that after we combine our beans, we'll have something still growing and roots there going into the winter and in the spring. Who knows? If we get bad winds again, we'll have some root structure there and some cover on the soil.
Boy, lesson well learned and great recovery plan. We could take up weeks, I'm sure, speaking about all the different aspects of what you're doing on your place, Axton Farms. But today I thought if we could just zero in a little bit on your use and making compost tea. You mentioned Elaine Ingham, of course, and boy, what a force she was in her life. Mm-hmm. She certainly helped a lot of people. But I'm thinking that growing grains like you do, you would have a lot of recycling byproduct to create lots of compost tea. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, especially with our seed cleaning plant, you know, we've got our good product that we sell. And then usually there's some, you know, that is feed quality. But then there's always grain that it's not even good enough for feed, which is perfect for composting. You know, it has the nutrients And we do thermal composting so that we can kill any weed seeds. We don't have to worry about those going back to the fields. And, yeah, it's really important not to lose those nutrients and be able to recycle them back into the soil. We've done a lot of large-scale composting, which is good. I don't think it's as high of quality as a compost as some of the more specific, like the Johnson Sue or, you know, just smaller piles where you can make sure the balance is a little bit better and, you know, add worms to get to that next level. But for us, we've got a lot of waste that we can compost. So right. We end up making windrows, and we can't make enough compost to cover all of our acres. So that's where we'll make an extract and just extract the biology out of the compost and then apply that back in furrow. And then we'll also add some biological foods at the same time. We haven't made as many teas. We have made teas and then sprayed them like as a foliar. But generally we'll do an extract, which basically is just your compost washed out with your biology. And then we won't add foods until we go in furrow. Just because once you start feeding the biology, they get a lot of active. They require more oxygen. And we just want to keep them alive and feed them right when they're going into the soil.
So once you have that grain byproduct, do you put each separate kind of byproduct? Do you put them together? Are they in their own separate areas?
We just pile it all together, and then with grain, we've got a neighbor that has like a manure pack. We'll usually add manure. We'll put in some bales. I really like alfalfa or slough hay to get some diversity and get that right carbon to nitrogen ratio for the piles to actually heat, but not heat too much, too fast. Find that balance so that we can do proper composting and get it to the right temperatures and then continually turn and water to produce as good of compost as we can.
Right. So in doing that, getting the carbon to nitrogen ratio, are there physical properties you can look at and see what it looks like? Is there testing you do? How do you work with that?
Because we have so much variability in not only, you know, the manure pack where we're grabbing, whether we get more straw or more manure, or in our screenings pile, you know, if we hit a place where it's been more of a cereal or more of a legume, the nitrogen levels, ours is kind of all over the place to start. When we mix it up and make a pile, generally, and then we'll monitor if it's getting too hot too fast, I know we need to add a bit more carbon, so maybe we'll mix in a bit more straw just to be able to bring down that nitrogen ratio so that it's not getting too hot too fast. Or same thing, if it doesn't seem to be heating, we know we need more nitrogen. And I check the compost often. You know, it's okay if it takes a while to heat. It'll just take longer to mature. It's just I don't want it to be too hot or get too hot too fast so that we're killing any beneficial biology.
So what would you say would be a long time or an optimum time?
To finish compost?
Yes.
Probably a year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. For us, for the large windrows, a lot of times we won't start them till later in the year just because you need to keep them moist. And in our hot, windy summers, it's a full-time job. It's just
right.
It's just too hard. But as I've learned more about the Johnson Sue and some of the smaller scale composts, I'm going to try some more of that on the side. And I think that would be more beneficial for the compost extracts and teas. Because honestly, if you have good compost, it doesn't take much to extract the biology out or make teas from. And it's better to have a high quality compost than a whole bunch of compost that's, you know, it just takes a lot more compost if it's not as,
of course,
diverse,
yes,
biologically. A lot of those take about a year. But I've just been learning more about the Johnson Sue method. And what I like about that is once it's cooled a bit and adding worms, just adding that next level. And then they aerate it.
Right,
for you,
yes,
which is nice, because that's a big thing. You don't want hot spots in your compost.
Right, yes, of course. Yeah. So if you're going to make a tea extract, how much compost goes into how much liquid? And then how much do you actually put on an acre, for instance?
So for our extracts, we generally do around 6 gallons an acre. I think, you know, everyone has a different preference. And as far as how much compost to water ratio, it really depends on the quality of your compost. Because I was fortunate enough to take Dr. Elaine Ingham's classes, I constantly monitor and just have a look. I don't do major counts. I just have a look to make sure, okay, yep, there's protozoa, there's some nematodes, you know, diverse bacteria. You know, and if there isn't, then I know, okay, we need to wash some more compost and get those levels higher. And you can send compost for testing, too, to find out the different ratios of, you know, fungi to bacteria and see what the quality is. And that would help you determine, too, how much compost you need per water. But there are a lot of variables.
Well, let me ask you before we move on, how often, you said about 6 gallons, you said, per acre you use?
Yes.
Yeah. So, and how often do you apply a compost tea? Is that an annual thing or?
Yeah, well, for our extracts, we put it in furrow at seeding time. So it's just 1 year. Mm-hmm. And we did that for about 6 years. Now, the last 2 years, my compost quality wasn't as good. And we expanded our farm and I ran out of time. So we haven't put any down the last 2 years. We're just making more compost now. We kind of look at it as like a probiotic, kind of a boost.
Yes.
But even after taking a couple of years off, I'm anxious to get more. And some of the new land that we've purchased, I think it could really benefit from some extracts.
Sure, no doubt. I mean, what is most striking to you when you're looking at one of your long-term fields that you've been working compared to another field, perhaps, that you've just acquired? What are you actually seeing, and what maybe is your first step?
Once again, a lot of times it depends on the history of the field, you know, what's been grown on it, because it can change quite a bit, and how much rain it's got.
Right.
But overall, for our long term, we're really seeing resilience. For example, a couple years ago, it was a really dry year, and we had seeded a lot of the same crops on both of our farms. They're only 12 miles apart, so they're not far. And that year had similar rainfall. And our yields were substantially higher on our home farm, I think just because of the soil structure and the ability to retain any moisture that we did receive. A lot of times you can see a difference in color, like definitely higher carbon. The soil structure, just more soil aggregation. And then to look at it, I do take soil samples and look at the biology, but honestly, that is very variable too, because it depends where you take the sample. If you take it really close to a root, you're definitely going to find more biology.
Right.
Versus if you take it in between two rows where there's nothing growing, there's not going to be as much. So it's one of those things that you can you can really change the results by where you take the soil sampling, which is one of the reasons we don't depend on a lot of soil sampling. We do more sap testing of actually plants to see what nutrients are actually being taken up.
That's really so smart. It's such a key point you just mentioned about where you're taking the sample from. That's really very good work.
Yeah, it's, you know, at first I didn't really think about it until, you know, generally you take, you know, according to Dr. Elaine Ingham's course, you know, so far from the root zone, and you try to be consistent. But then I started noticing if it was a healthy plant, I would find more biological diversity. And if I was looking at a plant, you know, went in the root zone of one that wasn't doing as well or was smaller or seemed like it was struggling for whatever reason, I would find less biology. So it definitely goes hand in hand. And then it's more to determine the reasons why, right? Why is this not doing as well? Why is there less biology? Or a lot of times it just comes down to disturbance.
Wow. And it's also interesting that when you do a soil test, you can find all kinds of nutrients, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're able to be taken up by the plants. And I know that's an important piece about the compost extract and teas, correct?
Yeah, well, that we found was just because, like you say, a nutrient in your soil, it doesn't mean that it's, doesn't tell you how plant available it is, which is why, you know, we went to sap testing and then taking a snapshot then of what is the plant able to take up, and then we build that fertility into our next year. You know, if it's low in a micronutrient, that's something that we'll add next year. Or if there's something that's really struggling, we'll make sure that field gets compost, or, you know, that's one we'll ensure gets a compost extract just to give it that boost that it needs.
Now, is the sap testing something you can do? Is that simply a Brix meter test or more advanced than that?
We send it to a lab. Mm-hmm. We take samples at certain growth stage and then send them to a lab for analysis.
I've read, and you can certainly confirm this or not, tell me I'm going down an incorrect path here, but if there is a drought situation, then the harvest time is earlier. Is that true?
Yep, quite often. Yeah, without moisture, the plants will shut down earlier, and hence your harvest is earlier, yeah.
And so how does that affect your rotation schedule? And maybe you can give a specific example.
Sometimes if it's dry, we like the extra window then to be able to get a cover crop seeded. The trick is if it's dry, it's hard to grow another crop. So it really kind of depends on the conditions. And sometimes it's not only the amount of rain, but it's the timing of the rain. Like right now, a lot of people are finding their hay crops are not doing well because we had late frosts, we had the bad winds, and we didn't get much rain until June. So the hay crops are really hurting. But now since we've had a little bit of moisture, a little bit of heat, we've still been kind of cool, the growing conditions change. So we have found that where we've had crops mature early because there wasn't enough rain when they needed it to really grow. But then it left us a window after we harvested, and there was actually some moisture to get a cover crop seeded. So a lot of times if you have an early crop, there probably isn't, you know, usually you don't have as much residue left just because not as much biomass has been grown.
Right.
So then
yes.
It gives us the opportunity to get a cover crop grown so that we can have, get some soil cover back and keep feeding that soil biology. Because if you harvest early, there's a lot of dead time where there's nothing growing and nothing feeding the soil biology.
Is there one grain or seed that you grow throughout? Was 2023 the first initial really like, okay, we're really working with drought condition here? Is there anything that through, say, the last 10 years or since you've been started actually early in the 2000s that you found has been the number one productive crop for you up there?
Like as far as a cover crop?
No, as far as what you're producing for sale.
The trick is the crops that we love for the soil are not always the best crops to market. That's what we struggle with a bit because we have our seed cleaning plant, we've got a flour mill, so we grow a lot of the specialty grains, and we do really like the ancient grains just because I think because they haven't been, you know, they're not as modern, hasn't been bred for higher fertilizer need.
Yes.
They produce a lot of biomass. But then marketing the ancient grains on the other end, you know, they're higher value, but you also need to be, you can't just take it to the elevator, dump it, and get your check. You need to find an actual market
right
for the grain because it is a specialty grain. So it kind of ebbs and flows. Like the cereals generally and some of the legumes, like a chickling vetch we grow, are really good for the soil, but some years they're more profitable than others.
I see.
So we're
yes.
really trying to establish some markets so that we can grow the right things at the right time. Sometimes we grow something, people are really excited about it, and then all of a sudden they decide they don't want it, and then it sits in a bin, which is really disheartening, but it's...
Is that because they can't find
learning,
the market,
you know,
for it?
Or trying to do more production contracts so that we're growing something that we know that we can sell in the end.
Right. What are you finding with the ancient grains? Are they more drought resistant than the newer varieties of wheat?
We haven't grown a lot of newer varieties recently. But we do, just looking at other crops around, we do find that they are more resistant, or more resilient, I should say, and a really good root growth so that they, you know, they're getting down maybe to some more moisture.
Right, yes. And so...
But then, yeah, once again, soil conditions, I think our long-term regenerative practices have really helped progress that, too, so that whatever crop we're growing has a little bit better chance.
Oh, definitely, yes, yeah. And so are you finding with the ancient grains, has the market woken up noticeably more since you've been started, or is it a very slow growth?
It's been really slow, but as people are really starting to think, we're seeing a trend where people are really caring more about where their food is coming from, how it's grown, what it is. Even a lot of the gluten issues, a lot of the ancient grains, people find them easier to digest. So we are seeing a trend in more and more interest. That being said, we struggle a bit with, because we're not organic and we're really not conventional. I guess you could put us in the regenerative category. We have done a regenerative certification with Regenified. Being in the middle is really hard because people don't always understand what you're doing. And so that, you know, organic has done a great job of marketing because people have an idea in their head of what organic is and what they're getting when they buy it.
But
so
they
for
don't.
Me, it's a lot of explaining that we do use some chemicals and some synthetic fertilizer, but at the same time, we test our grains to make sure they're chemical free. And our focus really is the soil health and what we can do to make the soil as healthy and cycling as many nutrients as possible and producing a nutrient-dense grain than it is following anyone's certain rules of how to farm. So it's kind of tricky marketing that way.
Right. Well, going back to the organic, that's the problem with organic is that, great, it's organic, but what does your soil look like? Because it has nothing to do. Now, a lot of organic farmers are regeneratively minded and they are working with their soil, but it doesn't come with a guarantee. I mean, I think organic by default oftentimes is something that happens because someone doesn't afford the money to be certified, which can be high for someone. And so I'm very curious about what you were just talking about, saying you don't use much, but you do use some fertilizers, for instance, but you test your product to make sure there's no chemicals in the end product.
Yeah.
How does that work? I mean, is it reliant upon, well, oops, we use too much, so there is chemical showing? Is that what it is a matter of?
Yeah. A lot of it comes down to timing and application.
Mm.
So we'll use chemicals early in the season to control weeds. We never spray glyphosate on any, like we never use it to desiccate. And I think it's kind of a no-brainer when you're spraying chemicals on a finished grain, they're probably going to absorb some. So that's easy to avoid. But even at that, we're never sure. You know, early in the season, doing some herbicides, it goes into the soil and then the soil, you know, plants take it up. So that's why we test the grains. I send it to a lab to test for the actives in the chemicals that we've used. We've done glyphosate testing for many, many years, and I've never had any glyphosate detected in any of our grains. So to me, that's, I feel like a lot of people who are looking for organic, that's a big part of it, is they want to make sure they're not eating any chemicals. So for us, that's why it's important to test, so that that's something that we can offer.
Right. And is that sort of a requirement of being certified Regenify? Is that what you said?
No, they're focused more on the farming practices and improving your soil health.
Mm.
It just really depends on the buyer. Because we sell to different companies that sell our grain as food, some of them require glyphosate-free and we'll do testing. So it kind of depends on the end user. I'm not sure what the rules are if you sell regenerative grain. It might depend what tier you're at, but I'm guessing it all has to be glyphosate-free.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something I've never thought about because we know that we are.
Well, in all things, doing less can be the answer sometimes. And is there an example of that that comes to mind for you regarding what goes on in all of your work with the farm and having the grain mills and everything?
Yeah, I totally agree. Sometimes less is more. I'm trying to think of a good example. It really depends. You know, sometimes we think more is better, but if you're not sure, a lot of times people are scared to do less and, you know, they're worried about losing yield. And that's where trials is nice. I think there's a happy medium of different things, and more isn't always better. I mean, we found that we use very, very little synthetic fertilizer, and a lot of our crops are zero. It's all our, you know, micronutrients and biological foods and compost extract, and they do just fine. So that being said, it kind of depends on where your soil health is at. There's just so many variables with farming. I have a science background. I was a high school science teacher. I love science, and it just makes it really hard to do testing when there's so many variables involved, you know, between our weather and even, like, we're rolling hills. So the difference between a hilltop and a low spot in one field can make a world of difference.
Sure.
Which is why we do a lot of variable rate things, even seeding and when we use any, you know, using some herbicides. Because different spots of the field need more or less of different things. So it's, yeah. It's not simple.
You mentioned that, Derek, your husband is an all-in. Okay, let's just do this. And is there either, do you want to share either a glaring, like, oh, no, we shouldn't have done that, or it's like, wow, he did that, and look what happened.
Yeah, well, the first time we decided to try intercropping, we did chickpeas and flax, and he did a 1,000-acre trial. And it worked. It was great. So that was a win. Actually, you know, it's amazing how we have lots and lots of mistakes, but anything that he's jumped in that is long game, you know, building our food-grade seed cleaning plant, which is a huge investment, and our flour mill, you know, the returns, it takes a long time, but just fitting with our system, you know, when you put all this work and care into the grains you grow and to go dump them at an elevator to be mixed with everyone else, this opportunity to be able to offer our own grains, and we know what the quality is when it leaves.
Yes.
It makes it fun. I mean, it's a ton of work. I usually say, yeah, Derek comes up with the idea and jumps in, and then I figure out how we're actually going to get it done.
Right.
so we make a good team because we've got, let's call him, he's kind of the visionary and I'm the integrator, and we usually find a way, but it's a lot of it, like I said, is mindset and just trying to keep your mind open and lots of pivoting. Lots of things don't work, but we generally learn something from it.
Oh, I'm sure you do, yes.
And yeah, do our best. We've grown lots of crops. We've tried to grow corn for years, and it just isn't even suited to our climate. But we know it's good for the soil, but, you know, we're just too short a season. And so it took Derek about 3 years for me to convince him this really is not working. But
yeah. And what about intercropping? Are there crops that you could mention that you definitely do not want to intercrop?
The biggest thing is the seed size when you harvest. Oh, I'm trying to think of what an example is. Can't think of a good one off my head, but when you grow two crops together, you need to be able to separate them.
Yes.
So making sure that that is doable and keeping in mind sometimes grains, you know, like lentils or even chickpeas will split. So even though they seem like a bigger seed, if they're split, they might be hard to get out of, you know, like a split lentil and a wheat seed. You know, anything that ends up like close to the same size and you can't separate them becomes a bit of a nightmare. So overall, as long as we can separate them, we just try to pick the ones that we like in the end, the better. You know, like the chickpeas and flax this year, yeah. We're working towards a little bit more of like the idea of a companion crop. Like I said, this is new to us, and I don't even know if it'll work, but like we put alfalfa with the beans so that after we harvest, we won't, of course, combine the alfalfa. It should hopefully be low and green still, but we'll have something still growing in the fall.
Right.
So that we don't have to try to get out there and get something seeded. There's no low period. There's just something growing pretty much every growing day of the year.
Right. That kind of reminds me of you and Derek. It's like there's no downtime.
Yeah.
Always
yeah,
something to do.
But it's, yeah. Yeah, it makes it fun. I mean, it's always very stressful when you're trying something new and if you don't know it'll work. And it is a bit of a risk. But right now with conventional farming, it's high risk too, right? To put all that fertilizer in, and the market prices are at all-time lows.
Right, and fertilizers
so
are
all-time. Farming, you're probably a bit of a risk taker as it is.
Yes, yeah.
So it's just, you know, think of different risks to take and financially what you can afford and what you can't afford to do.
Right. Whenever I hear about the fertilizer prices going sky high, I just go, yay. Maybe people will stop using them and figure out the better thing to do.
It's funny, when that happens, we get more and more people calling us and asking questions.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
We generally have had a field day every year. This year, we're hosting a bigger event called Horizons, where we're inviting people to come for 2 days.
Thank you.
We've got great speakers, like we've got Gabe Brown coming and Joel Williams, and we're going to do panels and seeding demonstrations and just get people together, a combination from farmers to industry to researchers and consumers. And
nice.
Like that's, we always find that the most powerful. You get people together and we want other people's ideas too.
Sure.
You know, nothing that we do is anything that we discovered, right? It's using old ideas or putting together, you know, two people's ideas and seeing what works on our farm.
So, Tanis, is there anything that's maybe hanging out in your head right now that you feel like, oh, well, we've been talking about all these things. Is there something that needs to be said right now that you're feeling needs to be said? Obviously, like I tell everyone I speak with, your expertise runs very wide and deep, but considering the subject matter we talked about today.
Yeah, I think the only other thing that we've really found is we were very focused on our regenerative practices and our soil. But I think there also needs to be a shift in the markets for the product that's produced and maybe awareness, you know, to consumers of what's out there and what it is. I think more people would do regenerative practices if there was they knew their product was worth more. Right now, a lot of times it isn't. It gets dumped into the conventional because it's not organic. But if there was a bit of a stream and if consumers were demanding it, then more people would be...
Right, know, yes.
More buyers would be buying it. And it's just, we keep hitting this wall where, for us, we're very fortunate that, you know, we're able to do some direct marketing because we have the facilities right on our farm.
Yes.
But for anyone else, I mean, don't get me wrong, the practices are worth it, and the money you can save or at least invest in something different instead of more fertilizer and more chemical. But I still hate to see that grain, you know, where is it going? Who is buying it?
And is it just going to get dumped in with all these other things?
Yeah, our food system is a bit tricky. Even when I talk to a lot of buyers, they'd rather just go buy from a big company where they know they can get large amounts. They don't want to deal with farmers. But then the mid-sized companies that really care about their ingredients. But I think if we had more people demanding, well, I want to buy from that company because they actually know where their grain's coming from.
Right.
you know, everything gets bigger and bigger and less connected between our food and how it's grown. But
right,
I do
but
fully see a shift in that area. So yeah. I think that'll help too.
Thank you so much. Everything you all are doing and others that are working like you, it is shifting, but not unlike that big ocean liner, I guess. You can't just turn it 90 degrees in a second, right? It's so funny when you said, well, I've got to make a flower delivery. And I just imagined someone delivering a dozen roses. And it's like,
yeah, I know.
Nope, not the kind of flower you're delivering.
Yeah, I know. I get that confusion a lot.
Tanis Axton from Axton Farms, Minton, Saskatchewan. Thank you. For anything we do here on Cultivated Audio, it's cultivatedaudio.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make here where we all want to be.